Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I'm Matt.
And today we're discussing robots, rent control, and Taylor Swift.
Yeah, so what do all three of those things have in common? Well, money, of course. That's what we're going to talk about today, how the stories that we've come across this week, how they apply to your personal finances. We've got those three stories plus several others that we're going to get to today.
That's right, Matt. But before we dig into those stories, before we get into the Friday flight, I wanted to quickly mention that I filed my first homeowner's claim in my adult life.
Is this something you're excited about?
Not really.
Typically, this is bad news, but I guess it kind of depends on how things shape up for you, right?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's not the worst thing ever, but it's also not fun, I would say.
Sure.
But basically what happened, the house that we're doing some work to right now that used to be a duplex, we're turning it back into a single family home for our family. Someone decided to get down in the crawl space and rip out the copper pipes with the sawzall.
Yeah, huge bummer, dude. Yeah. Actually, so I was the one that discovered it,
you
right?
Did.
Because Kate and I and the kids, we were just out for a walk and they had recently like busted out the back wall of your entire house, and which is to me super fascinating. Like, we're really interested in stuff like that, and so we went snooping. Well, Emily, she like sent us the lockbox code and was like, hey, go check it out, you know. So we poked our head in there. Y'all had just left town, I think, and Kate was like, do you hear that? Does that sound like water running? I was like, yeah, I don't know why the water's running. And sure enough, we kind of poked our head down through the floor and saw like a river underneath your house. It did not look like something that was planned. It was not a good thing.
And no, it was not. And yeah, so that water ended up ruining the HVAC system and, you know, a couple other things down there. And it was one of those things where I had my deductible set as high as possible, and that's something we've recommended on the show. And I had never had to file an insurance claim before, and so I was like looking pretty, just saving money every year on the money I was paying to the insurance company, but it came back to bite me in this instance. But I will say, I need to do the math at some point and kind of see, well, what's the difference? How much am I saving on an annual basis? Because I'm sure I have more than made up for the additional deductible amount that I had to pay in order to replace the HVAC system and fix, you know, some of the other things that were ruined by this act of vandalism. But I think that advice still holds true, because yeah, one of the other things that it does is having a higher deductible prevents you from filing needless claims, because if you have that really tiny deductible, you might start doing it willy-nilly and then your rates start to go up over time. And so I think this one claim hopefully shouldn't have too much of an adverse impact on the premiums that I pay.
You'll find out next year.
Once the renewal comes up.
Right. Well, so have you heard from them at all? Because oftentimes you hear stories about how when you file a claim like this, it's not a tiny claim, but it's also not like a massive claim. It's
right.
Not like a tree fell
it's
through
in
your
between,
house.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious if, because sometimes individuals will get booted from their insurer because once you use it, you lose it.
Yes, I have heard that too.
And so obviously that hasn't happened to you
it
yet.
It hasn't happened
but
yet,
I think
at least.
The higher rates is definitely something that's worth revisiting once you do get your bill or your premium for next year, because that's unfortunately not something that you can shop around. I mean, you can shop around your home insurance, but when you take advantage of your insurance, it goes onto your CLUE report.
That's right.
And that's something that follows you from one insurer to the next.
Yeah, that's like the database where every insurance company can check
yes.
and see, oh, does this person file claims or not? And yeah, hopefully one claim isn't going to mess me up. And it was the right thing to do,
sure.
Even though it was tough, because I'm one of those guys who's like, nah, I'm going to go through all my life and never use this insurance. But that's what it's there for.
There comes a time when you do want to use it. And like you said, though, it is tough to know how much you're saving until you actually crunch the numbers. But that did cause me to go and check my homeowner's insurance, because we just hadn't touched our home policy in a while. Dude, my deductible was set at $1,000. I'm getting hosed.
That's too low.
Yes, I'm getting hosed every single year. And so I immediately wrote an email to our insurance agent, because I don't know how that happened. But at some point, I mean, I know I didn't set it there intentionally, but at some point I think it reset, or they just automatically migrated it down to whatever the standard policy is. But I'm sure that you're wishing that would have happened to you. if only we could trade places.
Accidentally, just weeks before the accident, that would have been great.
Yeah.
Well, report back and let us know what the difference is,
sure.
Like how much you're able to save. Because I'm curious. My assumption is it's probably a couple hundred dollars a year.
I'm hoping by boosting that deductible, we should see a significant savings every single year. But I'll let you know.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, and nobody needs to shed tears for me. Not a big deal.
Yeah.
But and ultimately, it means we're getting a new HVAC system. Like, this whole house is going to be new at the end of the day.
You really are going to be set, dude.
It's cool.
Bank account's taking a beating right now, but you'll be set for a while.
Yeah. Hopefully, that means that no repairs needed on this house for a long time.
Good 20 years.
Yeah. Well, let's move on. Let's get to the Friday flight.
Let's do it.
The stories we found interesting this week in the realm of personal finance. And first, let's talk about budgeting for Christmas. There was a new survey.
Is this something you do, Joel? Budget for Christmas?
Well, I try to keep that budget minimal, but obviously we there is money that gets spent every year around the holidays when it comes to gifts for our friends and loved ones, or experiences that we share with other people, bringing something to a holiday party. Those are all the kind of things that you got to plan ahead for. And there's a new survey from Ally Bank, and it reveals that 32% of Americans are worried about going over budget this holiday season. That makes sense to me, especially with inflation, which we're going to talk about in just a little bit. It's like, everything costs more. Am I going to be able to stick to the budget that I have? People don't want to overspend, and we're all about that. But the statistic that followed in that same survey revealed that 2 in 5 people, they're not doing any planning. They're not using a budget at all. And so, 40% of people who are like, I'm really worried about going over budget, the budget that I don't have. I found that interesting. And it's going to be hard not to go overboard if you don't have a plan, if you don't have any sort of budget when it comes to your holiday spending. And so, no wonder you're worried about it. If you want to prevent what we would say a January financial shock that can linger into the summer months, well, you need to get a plan in motion now. You need to be prepared with a budget for holiday spending.
That's right. And of course, I was making fun of you because you tend not to budget in the formal sense. Like, you don't track every cent that you spend like I do, but you still have a more of a shoot from the hip spending plan, and certainly when it comes to something like Christmas. But the number one thing that we think folks should make sure to do, in order to not go overboard, is just to develop a list of people that you plan to buy presents for, and just don't overdo it just because maybe you have a little more cash sitting around in your accounts this year. You don't need to buy anything, for your third cousin who's twice removed.
Hey, we're very close, Matt.
If that's the case, then make sure to buy them a nice gift. But just make sure that you have communicated with folks, with your family, who you're close to, who you don't plan to exchange presents with, because part of the reason we tend to go overboard is out of this sense of obligation and this almost reciprocal non-spoken agreement that we seem to have, especially with family members. But write down the specific amounts that you aim to spend on each person. We've talked about this somewhat recently, but even consider giving cash with just a thoughtful handwritten letter or a note. That can be a great way for you to avoid finding your spending continuing to increase throughout the holidays, maybe even giving a fun experience instead of a high-priced item. But just don't overdo it because of the, you can't blame it on the holiday spirit. You can't say that like, this is something I feel like doing. We don't want you to approach your spending that way. We want you to have a plan.
Yeah, getting in the Christmas spirit or the holiday spirit is a great thing, but if you know yourself and you're the kind of person, because the jolliness takes over your soul, that you just start spending dollars like crazy, you want to have a plan so that you don't do that.
Yeah, well, and one of the other things too is just avoid spending on yourself, because you see all the money that you're spending and you think, holy cow, like, I am spending so much money on other people. I am being so generous. I deserve a little bit of that. I'm going to treat myself. And that's another way to add a solid, 10% onto your holiday spending budget, were you to start buying some items for yourself. And so that's something we want you to avoid. And by the way, we're going to go into depth about how to have more of a minimalist Christmas. We're going to talk about that on Monday with guest Meg Nordman. So you can look forward to that.
No doubt. All right, let's move on, Matt, let's talk about Taylor Swift for a second. You're a big fan, right?
I am not a Swiftie, but I do like some of her music.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and me too. Like, I like a few of her songs, but I only really listen to Taylor Swift when my wife is listening to Taylor Swift. And you know what? She's talented, just not my jam.
She's got some skills.
Yeah.
Or I mean, specifically recently, her music's gotten a little darker. Yeah. I dig it.
A little more of an indie vibe to some of the stuff she's putting out. Well, yeah. And if our listeners remember, we just had an episode about ownership recently. It was episode 425. And there's this news story this week that, to me, reflected the power of individual ownership and how it leads to building wealth, and just like a real substantial pop cultural moment. And this was really Taylor Swift, right? Like, she's more than just a good musical artist, as it turns out, adored by tens of millions of people. She's incredible businesswoman, and she actually just re-released an album that originally came out in 2012. Why did she do that? Well, because the rights to her original songs were sold out from under her, and they now belong to like some hedge fund or something like that.
Sold to the hedge fund by some guy named like Scooter or something like that, yeah. Right?
Apparently Taylor and Scooter are not on good terms.
Yeah, they're at odds.
They're not celebrating, not going to be at the same holiday parties is my guess. But she re-recorded those songs and re-released them, and that meant that she owns the music that her fans are now listening to. No Swifties are going back and listening to that 2012 album. They're listening to the 2021 T-Swift version,
right.
The one that Taylor is now profiting from because she owns it directly.
And it's also, at the same time, it's devaluing those original recordings in a significant way.
I'm not sure which one she's happier about.
Probably, considering where she is with her finances, I'm sure
the
latter is probably a little more enjoyable at the moment. And, you know, she already did this with the first album that she did this with was Fearless. And that album sold almost 1 million copies since April. And those newly recorded songs have been streamed 600 million times. And so this is just an awesome, I don't know, even though she's a total celebrity, this is still a very fun success story when it comes to an individual and their business acumen. Because Taylor, yeah, she's got that ownership over everything that she's creating. That's incredibly powerful. And again, it just goes to show how important it is to be an owner, not just a consumer.
Yeah, we see that clearly in Taylor Swift's example. It's fun to see someone not just be a great entertainer, but also great business person as well.
Yeah.
And so, just kudos to T-Swift on that front. And yeah, Matt, let's keep moving though. Let's talk about inflation for a second. The costs of essentials in our lives have been going through the roof.
Well, cost of everything has definitely been going up, but yeah.
And quickly, right? And gas prices in particular are something that's on everyone's mind. The state of California actually is setting gas price records this week. Those are the kind of records you prefer to remain unbroken. Especially
there
if you
are
live
records
there.
That they're not celebrating in a positive way.
And don't drive an electric vehicle in California. If you have a gas-powered vehicle there, you're probably like, not happy. And the national average of a gallon of gas is almost $3.50. And when you run the numbers, Matt, this costs the average person $69 more every single month compared to where gas prices were last year. And that's real money for lots of folks. Like that's a whole lot more money.
Oh, yeah.
That's going straight into the gas tank just to get where you need to go. And of course, you know, we talked a little bit about e-bikes last week. It only makes more and more sense to go in that direction when we see those numbers. But also grocery store prices are rising sharply. And in fact, you know, prices for meat, poultry, and eggs were up more than 10% in September. And so we're seeing shoppers having to make decisions at the grocery store so that their grocery budget remains intact. They're trading down for lower priced items because of how quickly these prices are escalating. And many are buying more store brand items instead of the name brand counterparts. That's something that you and I are all about.
Yeah, we're all about that. We're less about switching to store brand beer. You've tried the Aldi beer before, haven't you?
Yeah, and in the Kirkland Signature beer too. Both. I'm not down with either of them.
I am willing to drink some of the, I think it's called Hopping Nomad or whatever is the Aldi beer. In the summertime, like after cutting the grass, I'm okay with an occasional six pack of that. But, you know, inflation, like basically we've just seen inflation stick around, right? Like we thought it was just going to be around for a few months, but it has been much more sticky. And store brands and substitutions are two great ways to curb costs as those rising prices continue their climb. But what else can you do? You know, Joel, you're talking about the high cost of gasoline. Well, on the gas front, not all of us can drive less. There are just sometimes places that we have to be. We may not have the option to work from home, and so that morning and afternoon commute is still going on. But there are a lot of us who can change our driving patterns and habits because a big chunk of the miles that we drive are discretionary.
And you might still have to get to work, but can you combine more trips and go to the grocery store?
There you go.
Once every 2 weeks instead of going like twice a week?
If you happen to work near a Costco, that needs to be something that you're doing. And the other thing too, a lot of those miles are within just a smaller radius of our home, so we really could hop on a bike a bit more for those shorter trips in order to curb our gas usage. And if you are going to get in the car, look at this is going to sound silly, but just accelerate a little more slowly, like coast. You notice this when you're riding on your bike, but there's this one stretch where I always take a right onto a more main road, and whoever's behind me, well, after they make their right, they'll come zooming past me, but there's always a stoplight like one block up, and they're just like flooring it.
it's just a waste of gas
for
right
50
there.
Feet or something like that. And I always just kind of like
slamming on the brakes again.
Yeah. Yes. And I always pull up right next to them. And sometimes I love it when I'm like even a car or two in front of them. And they floored it. They wasted all that energy. They've lost their whatever, their patience. They've lost their cool. But just take it easy. And the other thing, too, we were talking about insurance earlier on. While you're already driving like a grandma, see if your insurance provider, if they offer one of those monitors or the driving trackers, because you know what? If you can combine gas savings with some insurance savings as well, that is two birds with one stone right there. And then, yeah, on the food front, where you shop is going to make the biggest difference. We've already mentioned Aldi and Costco randomly, but those stores can make a massive difference in your food budget. Lidl is also another affordable option, but we want you just to constantly be challenging what it is that you've always done in order to see if you can save a little bit here and there, because you might find that these are patterns that stick. And even when groceries are dropping in price, if you maintain those habits, well, then you're saving money every single month. You're not just breaking even. And so just even simple things like buying sale items, throwing them in the freezer, doing things that you haven't done before in order to curb your spending.
Yeah. And just stop eating steak right now, probably. I mean, it's a rare delicacy for us. It's like once a year, I feel like.
Seriously.
But when we do have it, it's a delight. But if you're having it on a weekly basis, you fancy and probably should trade down to chicken or meatless Mondays or whatever you want to do. But we've got more stories to get to on today's Friday Flight, including that robot story and a really interesting one about rent control. We'll get to those and more right after this break.
All right, we're back, and before we get to that more heady academic topic of rent control,
putting our economist hats on.
We actually are going to do that. But before we get to that one, let's get now to our ludicrous headline of the week, and this one is from Fast Company, and it reads, "Science proves it, most NFTs are worthless."
You know what? I'm going to trust science on this one.
Well, here's the thing. It's less about the science, and it's just kind of like the simple numbers. It's like empirical evidence. It's just data. It's like
I love that they wrote science.
Where does science actually come into play here?
Yeah, it's not. It's like really like we've just looked at the actual sales prices of NFTs, and we found that. But
science sounds a little more fun, I guess.
Like we just discovered a new
statistics.
Yeah.
But this article focused on the research from the University of London, which pored over the sales data from thousands of NFTs. And oftentimes, the NFT sales that make the headlines are for the different NFTs that might go for tens of thousands or even tens of millions of dollars in the case of that Beeple NFT that sold for like $70 million. But here is an interesting little tidbit. 3/4 of NFTs actually sell for $15 or less, and actually only 1% sell for more than $1,500. And so the CryptoPunk NFTs that were, all the rage for a minute, those are extreme outliers. But this doesn't mean that NFTs aren't here to stay, but at the same time, we're not saying that, the space is only about making money or getting super rich, because, even if it's a digital piece of art, it's okay to buy it, but only buy it if you like it, if it's something that you can somehow remove the knowledge that you have of NFTs and what they have sold for, and if you can just evaluate it from just a sense of appreciation. I don't know if that's something that anybody could actually do, by actually removing the dollars and cents from it. But if that's something you can do and it's something that you're drawn to this NFT, then if that's the case, go ahead and buy it. But it's just important to know that the latest, the new NFT that you scoop up is very unlikely to actually make you any money. I see this almost as like a wake-up call for those who are making NFTs to realize that they're probably not going to get rich that way, but then also for those who are looking at investing in NFTs, that's also probably not going to pan out well for them either.
Yeah, I think it's really good to see the actual statistics, and it's kind of like a bucket of cold water being tossed on your head, that kind of helps you wake you up, because the only real facts and figures we typically see are just the rarest of the rare NFTs that are selling for like bukus of dollars, and people just assume, all right, that's base. That's where I'm going to go make my money. Mm. But it turns out most people are making next to nothing, really on the creator and on the investor side. And like you said, Matt, I think you're right. Like, it doesn't mean you can't buy one if you want to.
Yeah.
Just don't think you're going to get rich doing
just
it.
Just do it for funsies. And something that was really interesting in this piece as well, in this article, is the researcher pointed out that the majority of NFTs actually don't sell at all. And so those are all data points that aren't taken into their calculations. Yeah. And so the figures are actually way, way, way worse because they're not even counting the ones that don't actually sell.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of people that post their artwork online and people are like, yeah, no, I don't want to.
Don't think so.
It's not even worth 50 cents.
That's weird, dude. Which is a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, and while we're talking about mostly worthless purchases, let's talk about maybe your worthless smartphone. And I mean, you like it and that's fine. But the question is your phone about to become worthless? And there was an article in the LA Times written by David Lazarus about this week. And he said, as 5G is springing up around the country, a lot of older phones are set to become bricks as 3G networks get shut down all over the place. And so if it's been like a really, really long time since you upgraded your phone and you're still running on like 3G, your phone doesn't do 4G.
If you've done that and managed to keep your phone working,
you're better than Matt.
Good for you. Yeah, seriously.
You're impressive. But it might be just a matter of months until you can't look stuff up on the go anymore. Like you won't be able to use data or make a call.
Like you can't even make a 911 call once the network actually comes down.
That phone is bricked.
Literally, yeah. Well, I guess technically you could use it at home as like a
internet searching device.
Yeah, like, yeah. As long as you're on Wi-Fi. Yeah. Maybe it's something you can give to your kids.
Yeah, yeah. It's not completely worthless, but it's mostly worthless. But
yeah, exactly.
This is probably a small segment of the population, probably not many How to Money listeners. And I just wanted to note, though, I could see people seeing headlines because there's probably going to be more headlines about this as the 5G network comes online. And people are going to assume that their 4G phones are also going to be bricked or become worthless. But that is not the case. Your 4G phone is going to continue to work perfectly fine.
For the time being.
You're just, yeah, but probably for years to come. But the thing is, it won't be as speedy as the new phones that are coming out. We would still say don't feel the need to upgrade. 5G, I'm sure, will be nice. It will be faster, but keep what you've got as long as you can. Matt, the phone I bought last year, it doesn't have 5G capability.
And still humming along just fine, though, isn't it?
I'm not jealous. I'm gonna stick with the 4G as long as I can. I don't care, and I think most of us should take that mentality. Just kind of keep using our phone if it works fine.
That's right. Yeah, don't be like me who splurged and went big time. So we talked about this a few months ago, how I was planning to wait until the new 13s came out so that the price of the 12s would drop and then I could pounce on a great deal, right? I don't know if we ever did an update, but fact is the 12 Pros never came down in price. Apple cut them completely from their website, and so I was stuck in this position of, okay, am I going to spend $1,000 on a 12 Pro or am I going to go ahead and get the new one? I ended up splurging, getting the new one. I kind of talked myself into doing it after having, you know, I sold like over $10,000 worth of photography equipment. So that was my justification saying that, like, okay, well, there's a net win here of $9,000. And so in reality, maybe I'm kind of coming out ahead. But in my case, I definitely splurged. But if you are not in a position where your phone is hanging on by a thread, like Joel said, we would recommend that you do your best to continue to make do. And the other thing too, is this not the most egregious example of planned obsolescence? It's like the cell carriers and then like the phone manufacturers are in like serious cahoots because they're like, hey, what kind of deals can we work out if you just start not offering 3G anymore so that all of your subscribers have to purchase a new phone that we happen to make? It's unfortunate because this is one of those areas where I think a lot of folks would be happy to continue using their old crusty phones, but in this case, they don't have that option anymore.
Yeah, Matt. And to be honest, I feel like, you know, I don't have any problem with you spending money on the newest iPhone because you waited like 5 years with
That's
your
right.
old phone. Like,
I earned it.
I think so. I think so. I think like trying to get, you know, more time out of your phone, just what we want to fight is that reactionary upgrade cycle where it's like every year I get a new phone or
sure
every
sure.
18 months I get a new phone. And we just think that's unnecessary, especially when we're talking about the phone upgrades being pretty minimal these days each
totally.
Year.
And I will say that I've gotten tremendous satisfaction out of the new features on this new phone compared to the original SE, which is what I had.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
And I figured you would because
it's so
as
great.
A photographer, you know, having the multiple camera approach.
Three lenses, dude. It's awesome.
I knew you were going to love
it. It's so great. I love it.
Well, let's talk about robots for a second. Businesses obviously are having a hard time finding the workers they need. We've talked about that. And in fact, there are more jobs than people looking for those jobs right now. For every one job opening, there's only 0.7 people looking for a job. And so, yeah, that just leads to wage hikes, of course, alongside just more leverage for the everyday worker. And then with compensation going up, though, some companies are deciding to turn to robots for certain specific tasks. Demand for robots is apparently also at an all-time high. And Matt, I would say it's going to be interesting to see what sort of an impact this has on our economy and on the workforce, because it makes sense. The faster wages rise, the more employers start to figure out how they can thin the herd, and robots are able to perform more tasks these days. Yeah, so what did you think when you saw that statistic?
Well, I mean, and just the fact too that, I mean, employers don't have the ability to continue to do business because they just don't have the people around to do the jobs,
exactly.
Right? And so sometimes, I mean, in this case, like it's a little bit less about the fact that the robots are here to take over, take over our jobs. And it's more, we've got to find a way to continue doing business here. And in this way, robots are the answer. But even for those who are a little worried about robots showing up, taking over our jobs, you know, this is, I feel like a topic. This is a fear that's been circulating for decades. And they never really seemed to come true. And so, for instance, it was thought that the brilliant new technology of the automated teller machine, the ATM, that would mean that most banks would no longer need human tellers, right? People who, you know, sit there and work at the desk. But that didn't happen. Not even close. In fact, as more ATMs came on the scene, we also saw a rise in the number of human tellers working at banks as well.
Yeah, not quite the apocalyptic scenario that some had predicted.
Yeah, exactly. And another instance I'm thinking of, the 3D printed house. These are starting to become a reality as well. And so a big question might be, you know, are they going to take away jobs from skilled laborers and contractors because these houses are being made by like tubes of concrete?
it's like a giant toothpaste machine.
It's like a soft serve machine that you can live in. But we think that that's pretty unlikely as well. But it is likely going to create more affordable housing. And those machines are going to lower the cost of living for many folks as homes become more affordable. But, you know, these robot headlines and predictions of rapidly advancing automation, at times they can be scary. But, you know, while it sometimes will negatively impact a few specific communities or specific jobs, it's almost always going to be part of a rising tide, you know, that helps the country overall more than it harms. And honestly, more than anything, it just makes me think of just the natural forces of supply and demand. Right now, there is just an incredibly low supply of workers. And so employers, they're having to get creative when it comes to manufacturing literally more supply by creating more workers. This is something that I think sometimes can be scary, but it's just the natural changing landscape of our economy, of our labor markets.
No doubt. So I don't think there's any need or reason to fear the robot, Matt, like you mentioned. I think you're right. And let's move on. Let's talk about rent control, our last story for this Friday flight. You know, we've talked about rising rents on the show, and it's certainly no fun to encounter if you're a renter and you're told that rent is $150 more a month for this next year-long lease. That's frustrating, and that can be a budget buster. But what are some cities trying to do to combat these substantial increases that we're seeing? Rent control. And St. Paul, Minnesota is the most recent example of this. They just passed a ballot initiative capping rent price increases at 3% a year. And that sounds nice if you're a renter, right? Saying that, hey, my rent's not going to go up above this amount. I know that it can't increase. But sadly, while rent control sounds good on its face, the effects are almost always harmful in the end. And landlords, they tend to stop investing in the units they own, leading to a more dilapidated housing supply overall. They would ask themselves the question, like, why will I spend extra to put in a nicer bathroom
right.
if they're not going to be able to recoup those costs?
Yep.
And yeah, pretty much at every turn when rent control is instituted, it ends up harming the vast majority of folks in that city where it's instituted.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. We feel that the answer isn't capping the rent price that a private landlord is able to charge. We feel that a better answer is to focus on creating more supply, just like those inventive employers who are finding ways to put robots to work. And so and we're not alone, too. Economists have been in complete agreement on this for decades. And in fact, Richard Thaler, the economist, he compared asking whether rent control is good to asking whether the sun revolves around the earth.
No, that's just lunacy.
Yeah, it's just like, I mean, it was just outside the realm of consideration for him. And so it's just interesting to see that there's a city that's going to be moving in the opposite direction. And for the folks who currently live in a rent-controlled unit, you know, it's great. It feels like it's like heaven. But for other renters,
if the market rate is $2,000 a month and you're paying $700 a month because of rent, your unit is rent controlled, you're like, I won the lottery.
Exactly. But for the other renters looking for a place to live, it becomes more difficult. And instead, we think that more relaxed zoning and creating incentives to build more units to increase that supply is the best way to create more affordable housing. Rising rents and the lack of access to affordable housing are real issues in our country, and they're, you know, more prevalent in some specific cities. But rent control legislation is just going to make things worse over time. This is an example where we're going to side with the economists, and we feel that the government, different governments, should consider involving themselves less when it comes to interfering in an open market like this, where, you know, the supply and demand can find their own equilibrium. And when you start interfering and placing rent controls, it leads to distortions within the market.
Yeah, Matt, it just makes me think the city where we live, Atlanta, passed a law a few years back that said that people could build a small dwelling unit in their backyard, which
called ADUs.
ADUs creates more density.
Accessory dwelling units.
The more units that are available for people to rent, especially in some of these older neighborhoods, the better. The better it's going to be when it comes to housing affordability. But then when you look at actually the zoning laws, it's harder than it would appear at first glance to build one of those ADUs, as I found out, because I wanted to put one in my backyard. And because of the setback laws, it was basically impossible to put that house in my backyard, even though the law made it somewhat easier than it originally was. And so those are the kind of things that need to be looked at. If the law doesn't just say that you can build an ADU, but then the zoning laws make it not too terribly difficult to do so, people will do it. And that will increase density. That will lead to lower rent prices for people all across the spectrum.
Yeah. Not surprising. Joel and I, we live in the city. We're all about density. And yes, in my backyard, please. We're all about it. And we think that that can alleviate some of the high costs of housing as well. But Joel, that's going to be it for this episode. Listeners can find our show notes up on the website. We'll link to all the different stories that we mentioned and covered during this episode up at howtomoney.com.
Yeah, that's right. And we'll be back on Monday with an interview with our friend Meg, who's going to talk about how to have that minimalist Christmas. We hope to see you then, but have a great weekend. But buddy, until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.